Welcome to the Pluralcast. This last week, I got to spend with the Patterns and Practices team and the other attendees at the P&P Symposium in Redmond, Washington. This was up on Microsoft's campus in the conference center. One of the great opportunities for discussion that I had was to sit down with Chris Tavares. This is the same Chris Tavares who developed Unity and is the lead developer for Patterns and Practices Enterprise Library. And we talked about CQRS, or Command Query Responsibility Separation, as an architectural design pattern. For those who follow the domain-driven design discussion out there and online, this is a topic that's been coming up quite a bit recently, so this was a great opportunity for me to learn a bit more about it. Chris had a great session, although only 30 minutes long, at the P&P Symposium on this topic.
It's wet, it's wild, it's scrumptious, I love it, it's delicious, nutritious, it's wonderful.
So you did something very, very different from your normal fare here at P&P this week.
Yes, I did.
And that was a discussion about CQRS, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I have to say a couple things before we talk a little bit about CQRS, one of which is the way you did your talk was super cool. I really thought it worked well.
Well, thank you.
Describe that a little bit, because it was pretty cool.
Okay, so I will admit I was very happy I pulled it off. I had a very short time period, and I was trying to figure out a story to hang the talk on.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, CQRS. Well, all I can think of is it's a really bad Scrabble hint. It's like, you know.
Well, my wife wouldn't let me have that as a Scrabble
hint. I know. Well, I mean, if you have it as a hint,
yeah,
you're in trouble.
Oh, yeah, good point.
And then it's like, well, okay, wait a minute. So I went out, I actually bought a Scrabble set, put the tiles down on my scanner.
You did?
I did. And then I cut and pasted the JPEGs from the scans to make all the letters on my slides.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. I didn't realize that you had actually scanned in little tiles from the game.
Yeah, well, you can't do that with a font because they were color.
Well, I just assumed you'd pulled all that off the web somewhere.
Nope.
That's cool. So the net result was your background was a Scrabble board.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the slides were spelled out in...
Well, most of them were, yeah.
Most of the slides were spelled out in Scrabble letters.
Yes.
So that was pretty cool. I learned that the term DB, if I were to allow that, is worth 5 points.
Okay, well then my mission is done. I have educated.
DBs are worth 5 points. Turns out CQRS significantly more.
Mm-hmm.
Were that to be allowed. Maybe what we could do with this is actually have an acronym-only game of Scrabble with geeks.
That would be really cool.
It's actually not fair, though, for people from Microsoft to play in that game, because you guys have crazy amounts of acronyms.
Unless we're playing against people from the DoD.
Right, government employees might be able to beat you. All right. So that was really cool, but really the intent of the talk was to help us understand a little bit about what CQRS is, and tell us about that. What is CQRS?
So I will preface this by saying that I have not been spending a whole lot of time with this pattern yet. So
it's a pattern.
It is a pattern. It's, I consider it an architectural level pattern rather than a lower level design pattern or an idiom.
And what do you think the distinction is between those two things?
So a design pattern is typically describing a piece of your system.
A little tiny one, or?
It can vary.
Okay.
But it is a subset of your, you know, your application.
All right.
Okay. Architectural pattern talks more about the application as a whole and how it fits together in an overall system.
Okay, cool.
So it's a matter of scale, essentially.
Yeah, all right.
CQRS itself is a pattern that is describing a way to build systems that are optimized for significantly larger readers than writers.
A reader being what?
Well, Amazon.
Okay.
Okay. Or Wikipedia. These are things where there are occasional writes. You occasionally click buy, But there's a lot more people looking at catalog pages.
Okay, so read versus write is simply the idea that I'm consuming more data than I'm adding to the
exactly.
pile.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
So CQRS is fundamentally a read-write
right.
distinction.
It's about a system that is highly scalable, because this is always... It's the problem everybody wants to have, where you know your system is getting overwhelmed because you've got so much traffic, and you're not being denial of service.
Mm-hmm.
And also, another kind of a precondition is that you are writing this for the average user, not, you know, a trained data entry clerk.
What's the distinction there?
Well, it turns out that the way the system is built is based around a series of commands. These commands need to, in order for the rest of the system to flow, need to be written in terms of tasks the users care about. Now, if you're running a data entry application, a reasonable command is add row. This is not a reasonable command, nor can you derive a whole lot of meaning from it in a larger context.
Okay. So it might be order product as opposed to...
Right, order things and here's everything in the cart.
Okay.
No, it's a larger chunk. You're not building stuff up incrementally.
So that sounds a lot like a sort of ubiquitous language or domain.
Ubiquitous language. Microsoft made a big deal about this style of UI, whose name I forgot. Inductive UIs, I think it was.
Okay.
It kind of fits along that idea. More you want to aim at, you know, what is their intention and express that directly in the command language.
Okay.
Rather than the details of how it got into the UI.
All right.
And the other thing is, if you've put up a data grid, you've failed. Because people don't think in terms of grids unless they are accountants, in which case their natural ubiquitous language will have a grid in it.
Well, I would think the ubiquitous language there would be simply Excel.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, that's the other point about these systems, is they are most definitely multi-user. If you're building something to write a document, typically one person's going to be working on that at a time, or a very small number. You do not gain anything by using CQRS in that environment.
So CQRS is divided in the middle, kind of, down
yes.
this idea of reads versus writes.
Yes.
Reads is show me a page.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there commands that say, go get the data to show me the page?
Actually, that's where the split starts.
Okay.
So let's back up a little and talk about domain-driven design for a second.
All right.
So the fundamental idea with domain-driven design is you analyze your problem space. You come up with a set of well-named objects, and you put the behavior in the appropriate spots, and then your UI is going to hit the domain to perform its functions. Now, in practice, when I've been doing DDD, I spend a whole lot of time on my domain not writing any behavior at all, but just writing the methods to get this, get that, get all the bits and pieces that are required to fill in your UI. And the actual functionality part of it is often smaller and a significantly different kind of work. So the fundamental idea here is the requirements for and constraints on what you need to do in order to read are different than what you need to do to write. So you end up with two models. One that is specific for reading, and one that is specific for writing.
Is the word model key there? When you say model, are you talking really about sort of a domain layer there?
Yes, but okay. they are two parallel models. They sit at the same point in your layer cake diagram, but they're separated as opposed to being merged together.
Okay.
And the read model is very often, and ideally, really stupid. Because... you want to try and pre-compute stuff as much as possible. You want to remember we're expecting to have a much higher ratio of reads than writes, and we've got multi-users. We want to scale. That stuff needs to get up on the screen fast. So the easiest way to do that is to make the model match exactly what the screen needs. So if you're using a relational database, you don't want a, you know, nth normal form database schema where you have to join 17 different tables and, you know, change a bunch of column names and stuff just to get something out into the screen. Denormalize it. Flatten it.
So is this the idea that I would actually take my view model representation of data and push it all the way down into my persistence layer?
Pretty much.
Wow, okay.
You gain a lot in scalability. There's a lot less work. You don't have to pull out, you know, any kind of ORM system. You know, it's a very, very, typically a very, very simple mapping coming out of your persistence layer. And there's also the only piece that we would have put in the domain model in the read side. All it's doing is doing the persistence to object model conversion.
You know, one of the things that I don't know that I fully understood when I saw it come up in your talk was you showed, you know, select star from, right?
Yes.
And it's almost as though that would not really, but almost be okay.
It is okay. In fact,
okay,
that's part
wait,
of this part.
Let's say that very carefully. Chris Tavares, inventor of Unity, master of the Enterprise Library, legend, says that select star is perfectly okay. Is that what you're saying?
In the appropriate circumstances?
Yes.
All right. So well, why is it not okay? The whole point here, we have a persistent store that matches exactly to our screen. If our screen changes, we're going to change that persistent store.
So I don't just have a table per entity. I have a table per
screen.
Per model view.
Pretty much, yeah.
Or view model, pardon.
Yes. This is actually part of the pattern. It's a bit prescriptive. It is prescriptive. It's going to get really, really tempting to, well, this screen's almost like that one, so maybe we'll just add a couple fields that's only used by this one. Don't go that way.
Oh, we do that already. We do it at the business logic layer. We do that with our domain entities already.
Yeah, but you don't have to with this model. You don't have to with this pattern.
What I mean is it's often tempting for me mm-hmm. to see reuse potential between
right.
either entities in my domain or in view models and up in my UI layer, and I'll say, let's just do a little inheritance here or something and you know, get some freebie reuse. But you're mm-hmm. saying, not only is that not cool, but it's so not cool that we're not even going to do it in the database.
Exactly. Now, why do we push against doing that? Why do we push towards normal forms and what that? Well, there's two reasons. Number one, cost of storage. And number two, problems with updates. Cost of storage, well, I checked fries.com yesterday. A 1.5 terabyte drive was $69.
Yeah, but isn't that like 300 RPM?
So buy six of them.
I'm just kidding.
As for problems with updates, well, we have a different way to approach that. But the other thing I like to point out is consider it in database terms. We make a distinction in the database world between online transaction processing, OLTP, and online analytical processing, OLAP, also known as a reporting database. So this read store we're talking about, this highly denormalized thing, is really equivalent to an OLAP cube that we're pulling from to show our streets.
Logically equivalent.
Yes, logically yeah. equivalent.
That makes sense. So it makes, or rather, a lot of folks will have different representations of the data based on their usage of it. You're mm-hmm. pointing at reporting, but we're saying also maybe based on the needs of the app.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
And also, I mean, the OLTP model is designed for and optimized around fast insert. Okay? We've already established in our pattern, we're optimizing around fast read. So that tends to push us more towards thinking, maybe I need an OLAP-style pre-aggregated kind of database on the read side.
Okay, so far in my head, I have this picture of a system architecture that, you know, divided into two, read mm-hmm. and write, and I think I have a pretty clear picture of the left-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And the left-hand side of read mm-hmm. is very much, you know, just take what's in that database and slap it up on the screen with as little code in the middle as possible.
Exactly.
Almost. Okay. So what about the right-hand side?
Okay. So before I say that, I just want to mention that in just about every other discussion or diagram or whatnot, you will actually see the read part of the CQRS model on the right-hand side of the picture. and the commanding or right part on the left-hand side of the picture.
Well, that's crazy talk.
Yeah, I know. I just didn't want to... I did not want to get into my talk and talk about the right side on the left. So this is my sum total of contributions to the literature on CQRS.
Well, it's a valuable contribution,
yeah, yes.
Chris. Right goes on the right.
Yeah, exactly. So, now the right side of the picture, obviously a system needs to go do something. You know, there's a user request, you know, they click the buy button on their cart. Something has to happen. Now, what happens is you have to arrange the system so that writes can be asynchronous. This is also how you pick up scalability. Because, you know, let's be honest, when you click that buy button, do you really expect that user to sit through the entire credit card validation process, the transfer of money from the bank, packing the order in the warehouse, and shipping it out to you?
That seems like a little bit long of a workflow me to get a page refresh.
Yeah, exactly. So we need asynchronous, we're going to need asynchronous support for most of this stuff anyway. So the pattern explicitly embraces that. The way it's done is all the write interactions from the UI, you know, typically when you push the submit button, what happens? It generates a command message. This is all highly message built based. Throws the message into a queue. That message is, you know, usually has a type like order this cart or.
Okay, so this must be why when I hear the CQRS discussion, what little I've read about it, frankly, online. It's often talked about in conjunction with things like in-service bus and having some sort of messaging.
Yes, or MSNQ is very commonly used, any of those.
Okay.
Yeah, you need a persistent queue in the picture somewhere.
All right.
Once that message goes out, the UI is effectively done. There's a bit more that has to be done, but we can talk about that in a minute.
Okay, so thank you for your order is what I'll see.
Exactly. At some point later, there's a process pulling messages off that queue. This part can be significantly less beefy in terms of scale, you know, number of machines. You know, it isn't as required to be parallel as the read side. It's pulling off commands, and then basically it's the command pattern. It pulls off the message, figures out what it wants, it does it. Now, the nice thing about this that I've found when working on this is the actual amount of work I need to do inside my bit domain entities is significantly smaller, it seems, because all I need to do is just provide, you know, the identity so I know what I'm talking about, know which entity in my system I'm talking about, and the actions it needs to perform. You know, it's been quite a while since I've had the luxury of writing objects that have no getters on any properties.
No getters?
No getters.
Well, a command, by chance, might do that, but...
Right, well, I mean,
but
the
talking
object...
about an entity in my domain with no getters?
Exactly. So I will take, for example, the sample that I used in my presentation. I wrote a small wiki. Now, granted, it's kind of a toy, but still. The primary command you get is edit page. And that command includes who edited it and what the new page contents are. There are no getters in my domain on my write domain for the page content or who last edited it. All there is a method saying page.edit. New editor, boom, new body. And in fact, based on my domain, the wiki page entity doesn't even load the previous history or the current page state because there's no operation that actually requires it.
On this right side, I remember when you were going through this discussion, you had a domain entity, I thought, that did a calculate cost of itself. Something like a shopping cart cost calculation. Yep. It'd be like shopping cart.calculate my cost. It was something like that.
Yep.
And I remember when you hit that point in your talk, it made me look at my feet. I didn't hear you for the next 5 minutes, frankly, because I looked at my feet and I was sitting there thinking, should that thing be calculating its own cost or should I have some sort of cost calculator? You know, stupid sort of object-oriented discussion that was playing itself out in my mind while you were...
Right.
While you're probably answering my question. But it really does, what you're saying now, bring up this idea that my domain model on that right side may be fundamentally different than I'm used to looking at a domain.
Yeah. And there's still certainly the idea of domain services in the DDD sense.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, depending on your business model and what your business rules are, your calculation may have to be switched in or out. That's typically done as part of the setup of the domain entity. You pull it out of the repository and you stuff in the services to do the appropriate thing. So, I mean, there's a lot of those still apply, but the way you build them is a bit different. And you can more importantly, you can concentrate completely on implementing the behavior. I don't know about you, but my experience, I spend a lot of time building the navigation stuff to pull my reads.
Yeah, that's true.
And you don't have to do that work on the right side anymore.
Okay, so one of the things that I've noticed, and I did this in Pluralsight.com. Mm-hmm. I've been working in code in there, and one of the things that we've done recently is put a commanding model in, mm-hmm. similar to what we're describing here. There's no queue,
right?
Because there just isn't at the moment. One of the things that I noticed is I'd get into some command, and let's say it's update card, even though we don't have a card. whatever it might be. Update a card. And I would go through in my command object, I'm banging out that feature in a vertical slice, right, through my system. And inside that command, I pretty much do everything. I would end up, you know, going and grabbing those order items. I'd go grab that shopping cart, whatever. I'd walk through it. I'd do the work. And then I'd realize, I'm not supposed to be doing that in the command. The command is supposed to be telling the domain to do that. So then I would go shift all of my code over into my entities. Mm-hmm. They would actually do it for me. And then the command ends up being paper thin,
yep.
right? And it simply does something like, you know, go get the thing, tell the thing to update with this data. Here's the data. And now persist the thing. Repository.save,
yep.
right? And is that still true in the model you're describing?
Yes, it is. In fact, I'd go a little further, considering that, you know, commands are explicitly messages.
Right.
Typically, you don't want to carry behavior along with messages. You just want to have the data.
Mm-hmm.
So I have the way that I did it, and I suspect most others are doing it, there's one other little piece. There's a command handler. It's the, I'm trying to think of what Feller called it. It's a little domain service, I guess, which receives the command as it comes in as a message, and it orchestrates the calls into the domain.
Oh, really? So now my commands aren't much more than DTOs that know how to validate themselves.
Exactly. In fact, I would argue the command doesn't necessarily know how to validate itself. That's done in the UI before it comes up.
That's a subject for another talk.
Okay.
But anyway... let's keep following that thread down into the database, maybe.
Yeah, and I mean the real job of the domain objects, the entities, is to execute business rules, okay, whatever they happen to be, and this is the part that's really different, is to output a series of domain events. Now, an event in this sense is not a C#, you know, hook up with a delegate, use the event keyword. Okay, these are another set of messages. They are also dumb DTOs. They just carry data. However, the vocabulary distinction between commands and events is actually quite different, is quite important, because you need to keep your mindset straight. Command is saying, go do something, domain. An event says, something has happened. In fact, inside your system, commands should be named with an imperative, you know, a go do. An event is named in the past tense, you know. Cart ordered, inventory refilled, page updated, something along those lines.
Now, in this case, what you're describing, first of all, is going to be familiar to anyone who's worked in a messaging system.
Yes.
Any sort of ESB.
Yes, yes.
Service bus type thing. Am I going to, or I guess typically do you, reuse that same messaging infrastructure for both the commands and events?
Yes, it's... really does leverage the capabilities of those systems.
Okay.
Now, with the command part, really all you need is a queue. It depends on how much fan-out you need to how many actual command processors you have running. Many systems can get by with just one. With events, on the other hand, you really need a pub-sub system.
Right.
Because events go to multiple listeners. Okay, I mentioned, you know, we had that read store... Okay, something's going to update that. So when does that read store actually get updated? As a result of one of these events going out.
Okay. Now, and might that be in another process?
It will almost always be in another process.
There we go.
And this is also, remember, I mentioned one of the goals here was scalability. Okay, well, where does that scalability come from? Well, that the web front end, or as a friend of mine likes to call it, the web head, is mostly doing reads against a store that's mostly static. We can duplicate that thing out the wazoo.
The write store?
The read store.
Oh, the read store, certainly.
So we deploy, and, you know, this is something that scares administrators and DBAs quite a bit.
So you just denormalized all of my DBA's data, and then you replicated it.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. There's no way that I'm going to be able to get away
with it. I'm going to get even better. Okay, assuming for whatever reason you're using a relational database to store your read store. Doesn't really need to be, but convenient technology, people's familiar with it. Put the read store in a database on the web server.
Because you're just trying to get it to the screen quickly.
Exactly. Why force an extra network hop? And this scares administrators terribly. It's like, what do you mean you put it in the database on my web server? Well, the thing to do there is say, well, it's not, it might be SQL Server. It's not being used as a database. It's a cache. It's a big, giant, honking, persistent cache. And you can rig things up, in fact, so that the web, even if the web server is compromised, set permissions such that web server has no write access to that read database. And you know what? So what if somebody compromises it? It only contains information you were going to show on the screen anyway.
So in other words, I'm definitely not storing my password hash in there.
Exactly.
Right? No credit card numbers, that sort of thing.
So it's safer. this is also one of the places where the NoSQL kind of projects really do fit well in that kind of environment because, you know, you're not normalized and you want fast retrieval. Mm-hmm. And even if updates take a while, so what? That's the other thing here. We need to embrace the fact that data's stale.
Well, you mentioned that in the UI interaction that I had, mm-hmm. which said, you know, okay, order, got your order, come
right.
back later.
Right. But even in, you know, and just like anybody who uses a reporting service, I mean, the very first thing you see at the very top of it is data valid as of. Mm-hmm. You know, or this report generated on. So, you know, people, and particularly in you know, in the web-based systems, you know, you go online to Ticketmaster, you know, you'll either wait because they've crashed or, you know, or ordering a plane ticket, you know the chances that the seats you thought you were ordering are probably no longer available by the time you actually, between the time that you see the seat chart on the screen and the time you actually hit buy.
Right, right.
So you just need to embrace that, accept it. There are things you can do to limit the amount of staleness that's involved. In many systems, you know, that's going to be less than a minute anyway. So unless you have really, really hard business rules and you can quantify how much they are costing you, relax and let the staleness happen because it results in a much, much more scalable system, which will cost you a lot less money in the long run and probably make you more.
So let's come back to the right side okay. for a second, and we got as far, I think, as getting to where we had almost put something into that OLTP database.
Mm-hmm.
Does that database represent the normalized single source of truth, or is that guy a denormalized insert optimized structure?
The denormalized source of truth is actually also optimized for, if you do it right, is also optimized for insert. But there's actually two patterns. There's another pattern that plays very well with CQRS to the point where it's often confused as part of it when it's actually separate. And that's the idea of something called event sourcing. So you can certainly, you know, have your regular, you know, ER diagram, multiple tables, foreign keys, that kind of database structure. Obviously successful for a lot of people, but, you know, then you have the whole ORM problem, the whole relational object mismatch, the impedance mismatch issue, and you've got to deal with it. But looking at this system, the events are coming out of the domain anyway. The events represent, basically give you a history of all the state changes of all your entities in your system over time. And, more importantly, you have to save the entire stream of events anyway. It provides an audit trail, and when you bring up a new read store, how do you populate that new copy of the read store? Do you just copy someone else? Well, no. What you do is you just replay the event stream. And at the end of that, it'll end up being matching the current state of wherever the rest of the system is.
So that cache or queue that's aggregating all of my events, that needs persistence.
That needs to be persistent regardless, yes.
Okay.
And there are lots of other advantages of having that event stream, which we can get into a little later. But the other thing is, okay, this is we have a representation of our system state over time anyway. Couldn't we just use that to load our entities? Do we really need the relational part at all?
No, wait, you lost me there just for a second. What do you mean by load my entities? Into the read cache?
No, into the write side. When you're pulling the... So, you've got a command coming in. It's going to operate on some entity in your domain.
Right.
Okay, so, you know, you're ordering something. Well, you've got to load your warehouse with your parts list. So you got to know what the current state of that thing is in order to process that order.
Right, okay.
Okay, so we need to pull that state from somewhere, right? So we can do it in one of two ways. We can either go out to our ORM, ask it to aggregate and select and join and do all that stuff, and get back and populate our entity and then process on it, and then go through the repurse process to write it back out into the relational store. Or we can go into our event stream and say, hey, I'm operating on aggregate route number 72. Give me the events that have happened to aggregate routes from 72, from creation till now, and we simply replay the events into the entity as part of the repository.get call, and the net result of that process is going to be an entity in the appropriate state.
Okay, sure.
Now, of course, you know, the first thing is like, won't that take a long time? In practice, of course, what you would end up doing is you would have a separate snapshot table, which can record the state of the entity in usually just as a blob, so it loads fast, as of, you know, particular points in time. And you just have another process just sitting there, and it snaps, it's following the event store and just snapshotting new aggregates over time. So the net result is, you know, if that thing's falling behind by like 5 minutes, okay, at worst you load from the snapshot, you'll have the state as of 5 minutes ago, and then you play every event after that.
So you're not talking about catching up my system from a year ago.
No.
Okay.
But, you know, if a disaster does happen...
Well, sure.
You can. You can still recover.
It's possible, right? But that's not necessarily where you're heading with the whole replay to state piece.
Right. So that's the idea of event sourcing. And this can that can actually be used in other... By itself, without CQRS, it was actually originally invented like 10, 15 years ago. And a bunch of systems out there have been using it, although I personally have not worked on one. Martin Fowler actually talked about that at his keynote at the PNP Summit last year.
So tell me about the PubSub typical model that we're going to find against that event store. What's interested in these things? Obviously, I want to be able to update state all over the place when one of these events comes in. So who's interested, and how do they find out?
Okay, so that's the last piece on the read side. That is the event handler. So basically, you have a set of these things. It may be one process, maybe multiple, depending on how you want to deploy your system, but they're going to be per read store. So if you've got five copies of your read store on five different machines, you're going to have five event handlers, one for each one.
And when you say event handler, are we really talking about something like maybe a Windows service or something that's going to
Something sitting on your PubSub bus.
Okay.
Could be a Windows service, could be... Well, it can't be a web app, actually could even be if you've got an HTTP endpoint open and the bus poked your HTTP request with a post.
Right, but somebody's got to be live.
Somebody's got to be live and listening.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So what happens is these events come out, go onto the PubSub bus, these event handlers have registered for it, and what is it registered for? Well, typically when you write the screen or you update the screen, you've got a set of... You know, just like we have command handlers on the write side, we've got event handlers on the read side. And you're going to have a set of those which correspond to the different events that come across the bus. that update the bits in your screen. And so as the events come in, the event handler process grabs it and says, okay, I need to do this, 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 and this. And the net result is all the appropriate tables in the read store have been updated.
So I'm just sort of sitting here picturing all that and trying to grok it again. That helps me a little bit because I did see some illustrations of how some of this works. But that's pretty elegant, man.
Yeah. It goes together quite well. It feels good. You know, once you relax about the, what do you mean it's not up to date thing, it cleans up a lot of mess. And the other nice thing I like about this pattern is, you know, when you sit down to write a new piece of functionality, you know exactly where it needs to go.
Now, that event handler itself will often do things. Well, maybe that's the thing that sends me the email that says, your order's been processed.
Exactly. And, you know, when you get bigger, you know, in an enterprise system where you're integrating with business partners and whatnot, it becomes a fantastic integration point to external systems. Because everything is, you know, it's going out as things happen to your system. It's live. You don't have to do anything special to get those out. You don't have to be watching files or something. And you know it works because you're using it. Which is always the fun part in these integration projects when you try to add a whole new integration point. It just becomes a standard part of the system.
Well, yeah, you know, backing up and sort of trying to look at this pattern from a really high level, you're finally showing me how to integrate against an ESB or some sort of message bus that might be huge.
Yes.
Right? But I'm just interested in my one little app and how it's going to integrate with that bus. Mm-hmm. This seems like a very reasonable way to tap in and make use.
Yes. It really does leverage the power of those systems. Puts the bus at a central point of connectivity, which is where it really needs to be. It's not something stuck off to the side they happen to use to talk to those two guys.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that went on here at the summit this week is I was lucky enough to sit in a room and we went through a process of architectural katas.
Yes.
Were you in that room?
I was not. I had to.
It was kind of fun. Everybody got a piece of paper that says, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. And your table talks about, well, how would you solve that problem?
Yep.
The problem that we were given is a national franchise of sandwich shops. Probably not called Subway or
probably
something.
Not at
probably
all, yeah.
Not called that. And
Quizway.
And order on the web. Mm-hmm. Right? Order on the web and fulfillment and that sort of thing as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? This sounds really elegant for that type of problem. The other thing that is a piece of a problem like that was elastic demand. Right? Because I've got this rolling time window of lunch and dinner.
Yep.
Right? And so one of the things we talked about is, could we put this in the cloud, right? That seemed to make a lot of sense to us. So would this play well there?
Absolutely. I actually have another sample. It's not quite ready to show anybody yet, but I've been building another content management kind of application on Windows Azure. I only had it in the dev fabric. I haven't actually gotten out there yet, but, well, you got queues already. Perfect fit. You've got worker roles and web roles, which let you host the various bits and pieces you need. You can build a pub sub system out of queues and or table store. I was just using table store for my event store. It worked great.
That was fine for a queue and you were flipping a bit for state or something?
So basically what I did was, so table store is a little annoying in that there's basically only, there's a partition key and a row key, and those are what you're sorted on. So what I did was I set my partition key to, and partition key got to be a string. So basically I set my partition key to a 20-digit sequence number. And then each of my worker processes that were watching that, so all of my event handler processes, basically had a counter saying, what was the last event I looked at? And then said, table store, give me the events with a number bigger than this. Now the nice thing about doing it that way is, you know, if they were on a queue, number one, queues it could be sender. Basically, only one reader will get a message off a queue. I specifically wanted to broadcast. Number two, if something went down between writing to the store and writing to the queue, then you could have lost either the thing in the store or the message on the queue. So it was just cleaner and less error-prone to do the table-chasing thing.
Okay.
And it worked great. It's... Yeah, it's, like I said, nowhere near done, but it is shaping up very, very nicely. And it fits well.
You're saying we've got all the raw materials we need in Azure services now.
To assemble a system like this. And, you know, Azure also fits really well with what you're talking about Elastic Demand, where, you know, you can just, you know, I got more demand, turn up more web roles. Now, the one thing you don't get with Azure is the ability to, like I said, put that SQL Server on the same box. But you can share, you know, you can. I was using TableStore for my read stores, and that seemed to work pretty well. You could certainly have multiple webheads sharing read stores, since it's all read anyway, and I'm sure there's lots of caching under the hood, regardless. And if that's a problem, you could certainly partition your read stores for per web role to point them at different things and help get them closer. And so there are certainly things that could be done if that becomes a problem. I have not measured it yet, so I can't say exactly what the thresholds there is going to be. But like I said, all the raw parts are there. It's looking really good.
Well, this sounds really appropriate for stateless systems, frankly. Although I know one of the pieces of code that you mentioned to me, we were talking about Mark Niehoff's implementation. It's a sort of a reference implementation of CQRS called Fogen, I believe.
Yeah, I have no idea what that means.
I don't know about it. You know, and it's Dutch, right? So there's way I'm going to pronounce that properly. Yeah. So, Mark, I apologize in advance. But his implementation is actually a Windows client, if I recall. And that's sort of the last missing piece for me is I know that in his implementation, he's got live updates flowing. And so what that must mean then is that his client's got the event listener baked right inside it.
Yeah, I don't remember how he wired that up. It could be a question of... I mean, there's a bunch of ways you could do it. You know, if we're talking Azure again, like the Azure Service Bus.
Well, for me right now, it's mostly a question of what do I do about a stateful, you know, rich client in this model?
The easiest thing to do is simply poll. And you can, you know, so you maintain a local cache of your read state, and you either poll the event store or you have some web service sitting on the front of it, which gives the information you need. You could put essentially have a cache or have on the online system have your read data available behind a service, which is updated through the normal, you know, event store, event handler system, and then have your client hit that at a regular interval. You could, although this would not be great for scalability, your client could just connect with TCP and leave a connection live and get stuff pushed to it. There are a variety of ways to do it.
So it was through some sort of communication pattern. Sometimes we're going to need a live update notification coming out of that read store.
Yep.
Yeah. That's what it comes down to, it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the web, you don't need that because, you know, the web is stateless and you go and get it every time.
Right, right.
A desktop app, you know, that obviously is not going to be an option.
Well, that sounds like a pretty cool implementation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have not been playing with it for very long, but I've seen it's been getting a lot of press on the web as a potentially very interesting pattern, and my experience in using it so far has borne that out, and I think it's definitely worth exploring further.
One of the last thing I'll ask, I think, is in my experience, much of the benefit of working in a prescribed DDD way like this and inside of prescribed architecture, which sounds like CQRS definitely is, much of the value there is that we get to, as a team maybe that's working on this thing, just have some convention that says, you know what, this is how you do that thing. Mm-hmm. Given that that's often an advantage when I'm dealing with a prescribed architecture, does this work okay for smaller systems too? Would you be tempted to implement your mom's website this way because it's just good form?
So you do need to have a lot of plumbing ready before you can start moving on this. You need to have, you know, you need to have something set up to build your read stores, pull your data out. You need to have a queuing system in place. You need to have event handlers. You need to be able to register command handlers, etc. Once you have that plumbing in place, then it moves very quickly. So I would tend probably not to build my mom's website with it.
But if I were maybe trying to set up a business, or I'm something that I very much wish to have the problem that I need scalability, then I would lean that way. It's going to take, it does take a little more work up front unless you already have the tools. But once you do, you get moving real quick.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk to you. It was fun.
Thanks so much for joining us for the show. This has been your host, David Starr, and I want to say thank you to many of the listeners who've been sending in show suggestions. We're definitely paying attention to that. I've got a great list, not only of topics, but even of potential guests that we're looking to get on the show that I think you're all going to enjoy very much. Thanks, as always, go to the Judies for use of their music. You can learn more about the Judies at wastedtalentrecords.com. Thank you so much for joining Chris and I in our backstage echo chamber. We're investing in some audio equipment here at the podcast, and I think we're going to be able to take care of all of our production issues, which is going to be great. I look forward to seeing you in class sometime soon. Don't be a hippie, 'cause only time will tell. Only time will tell. Yeah.